Hello, and welcome to Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. My name is Ben Miller. I am CEO and co-founder of Fundrise. Before we get started, I want to remind you that this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. We have a special guest today, Robert Johnson, who is one of the world experts on the interplay between finance and government. He, along with George Soros and Stanley Druckenmiller, are also known for taking on and breaking the Bank of England, one of the most famous trades in history. His background in economics, finance, currencies, Fed policy, East Asia, China, banking, and financial regulation is second to none. He is a renowned name in finance. So, without further ado, Robert Johnson. Rob Johnson, welcome to Onward.
My pleasure. Nice to see you.
So today is Monday, March 13th, 2023. Silicon Valley Bank failed on Friday, 3 days ago, and the country seems to be on the brink of a banking crisis. So before we get to the present, because I have a lot of questions about the present for you, I wanted to go back to a seminal event from your past to help frame the conversation for the listener. So if you don't mind, I would start with the Bank of England, because a lot of our listeners don't know the full story. It'll help them understand your unique perspective when we cover other topics.
Okay, so you're talking about the British pound devaluation in September of 1992. Is that right?
Yes, September 16th, 1992.
Okay, I had come out of the government. I had worked with the United States Senate Budget and Banking Committees. And at the time of the 87 stock market crash, quietly, I was running hearings and George Soros came and introduced himself to me and said he wanted to help me understand what had happened so I'd make the hearings or work with the Brady Commission and so forth. But he didn't want to be a witness. But we had nice conversations. And a little bit later, he was doing a report on the transformation of the Russian economy as the Soviet Union was coming and buckled. And I worked on how do you create the relationship between the central bank and the parliament, like I was working between the central bank and the Congress. So a couple years later, I went north to New York to join Bankers Trust Company as a strategist and then eventually a currency trader. And I thought, man, who could be a better mentor than that guy up in Midtown named George Soros? And so I started talking with him and Stanley Druckenmiller, who, in my opinion, at that time, and maybe even still, was what I call the Michael Jordan of traders. There's a man named A.J. Liebling, used to say, I write better than anyone that writes faster and faster than anyone writes better. And what I say about Druck is he knows equities better than anybody does macro and macro better than anybody that does equities. His lateral pattern recognition was just genius. So I did not join them right away, but I continued working on the ERM, European Exchange Rate Mechanism. And as German unification took place, one could see some fault lines on the horizon. Simply, you could see that the Germans had to do a big fiscal stimulus to build up East Germany. You know that the German economy was very averse to inflation because of some historic traumas from the Weimar Republic and beyond with hyperinflation. So you said they're not going to tolerate a lot of inflation, but they're stimulating aggregate demand. Well, when you look at Great Britain, they're another potential reserve currency, a lot of liquidity, but they're in this fixed bandwidth. And the British economy is very interest sensitive. So you're saying if the Germans aren't going to cut rates because of inflation while they're doing a fiscal stimulus, they either have to revalue the exchange rate or the British are going to have to devalue. And if the British try not to devalue to stay in that little bandwidth, it was like 3.25% window, they are going to have to raise interest rates and basically crush their economy. So I had discussions with Stan and George about that. I joined them and became a managing director there. And we could see those stresses accumulating. And also as it pertained to France or Italy or Portugal, Greece. And these were all places where I traded and visited continuously while I was at Bankers Trust. But how would I put it? There was an intuitive genius and courage in George Soros. And Stan was, like I mentioned, the Michael Jordan of traders. So they had a confidence and a courage, and they would engage in a kind of leverage that Sebastian Mallaby has written about this episode in his book, More Money Than God. But I joined them because I knew they weren't going to be afraid about losing a banking license or something. They were just going to go after making money. And so we implemented that strategy together. And the British pound was under stress, and they tried to raise rates and then raise rates again. And then they said, ah, to heck with it, and capitulated to what I thought was structurally inevitable. I don't think this has anything to do with what you might call a synthetic creation of a devaluation through pressure. Obviously, when someone as famous as George Soros steps up with $10 or $15 billion, they had about 22 billion pounds of reserves. But when we put that much pressure on, many people joined us. And it was just a matter of a few days to, as they say, break the pound, break the Bank of England. Subsequent to the event, Stan, very courageous man, very ethical, and he and I got on an airplane, and we went and visited the Bank of England, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Then we went to Germany, and we went to France and other countries, and explained we weren't like wild coyotes. This was a structural thing related to German unification. It was a systematic break. While I was at Bankers Trust, there was a prelude to that because the Finnish government was much more exposed to the Soviet Union. So when the Soviet Union collapsed prior to German unification, the Finnish marka had devalued, and I had played a role in taking advantage of that. But that was, again, a structural play. But a lot of people think a small business firm with 60 people took on a reserve currency and won. What kind of balance is that between governance power and... So I understood the controversy. They had a lot of hearings in Washington. George and I went, sat together and testified. I used to conduct those hearings, so I knew a lot of the people. But George was paying his taxes. He was doing everything honestly and ethically. One guy said to me privately, Michael Milken made $500 million a year. We figured out what he did, and we put him in jail. We're going to get you and Soros on. We'll find out how you made $1 billion in a day. And we might put you in jail, too. And that individual who I had known for years said that to me. He was a member of Congress. After the hearing, when George explained what we did, how much he'd paid in taxes, that man posed for pictures with Soros. And everybody knew there was not an illegal dimension to what we did at all.
So I remember you telling me this story briefly, maybe 18 years ago. You and I were sitting outside on lawn chairs. And what I remember now was you saying that you were in Europe at a meeting with a bunch of central bankers. And the line I remember was, you looked around the room and you thought, these people are lying. I just remember you basically, you had a read on the bankers and the psychology and the sort of forces on them.
Did this pertain to the ERM devaluation as well?
Yeah. Basically, they were saying they were going to stand behind the exchange rate mechanism, ERM. And you looked around the room and you said, no, these people are lying. They're not going to stand behind it. They can't.
My, how do you say, intuitive radar in those days was like not to sit and argue about reports or working papers or whatever. I'd go out and have dinner with people. And if I'd ask them a question, I could sense their discomfort. It aroused my curiosity. And I remember being at a number of small conferences where 5, 8, 10 people were central banking officials would be there. By the way, because this is before the British pound devaluation, these people are used to me as a former policy person being a friend who they have candid conversations with. They now understand my new role, which is an investment strategist and a trader managed a fund. But there was still a kind of camaraderie, and I could feel the emotions of not just I don't know or I'm reluctant. When they became self-protective, meaning they knew something was wrong, they didn't want to lie to me, but they didn't know how to work their way out of it and be candid, and I could feel their dilemma, which underscored my curiosity.
I've experienced that when I'm negotiating or underwriting an investment and you're talking to somebody and they're telling you something and you're like, they're obscuring something. It's a half truth. That's like a red flag. There it is. Dig.
It's not a confession. It's a reluctance that creates an intuitive awareness that there's something that's hiding behind the door.
Right. There's some dissonance in their story and the way they're behaving. Totally.
I'll give you a good example. I was mentioning the Finland. I had my family, and this was, 1991. I took my family to France. My wife had worked for years in France with Le Monde, the newspaper. And my children were preschool age, so they could bop around. And I got on a plane and went up to Helsinki about three times every 2 weeks. And I was with a bunch of people who I'd known. One was from graduate school and others. We go to dinner. And how would I say, Finland likes to drink alcohol. They start in the middle of the afternoon.
Well, they are next to Russia.
Exactly. So the vodka or whatever is flowing. But I said to him, okay, you guys, you're in this stress because the Soviet breakdown, your export sector is under pressure. I don't understand why you don't devalue, because you got like 15% unemployment. If you devalue, your inflation rate is not going to surge. You've got a lot of slack in your economy. And they just started telling me enthusiastically about all of the simulations and scenarios they were doing about what a devaluation would mean, which told me their government was considering a devaluation. And until very recently, I had had about a $2 billion position in Europe, and the biggest long position was the Finnish marka. And so I tried to be very ethical with them, and I said, I don't want to alert the markets, but I want to close out that position. And I'll work directly with your desk at the finance ministry to close it out quietly. And that was like Saturday, and on Monday I went in and did that in person so that our books were square. And then I left, came back to France. But I could smell, when talking technocratically about the scenarios, and they admitted they were doing simulations, that the probability of that devaluation was not insignificant.
Right. So actually, I try to circulate what I call operating principles of the company, because there's certain principles that are universal that I feel like people have to learn over decades, and you can maybe get shortcuts. So one of them I call is knowing versus analyzing. And then a lot of people use Excel spreadsheets and they research, you know, analysis. And I'm like, just go there, talk to people, because you can know the answer by doing the street hustle. The analysis only give you like a conjecture of what ought to happen, but you can get to like a knowing. You can get to, you'll know what the answer is if you just go do the actual like hands-on work.
Well, I'll tell you that you're a younger generation than I am. When I started in this business, there were not emails. There were no Bloomberg machines. You had to get on the airplane to go talk to people. And when I set up in Asia with a brilliant young man named Rodney Jones, who I worked with both at Bankers Trust and then Soros, he used to visit like 9 countries every month to get their budget and central bank data. And when nobody had a system-wide intra-Asian market model, Rodney built one, and we felt like, how do you say, cross-currency trading and playing macro medium-term themes was like taking candy from a baby. But as the Bloomberg machines and the digital came on stream and email, in person wasn't as necessary to collect data, but it was still necessary for exactly the reasons that you provide. How do you say, can you smell a rat? Can you feel somebody's not telling you, or protecting something by avoiding discussing it, things like that, which are another dimension of clues.
Right. And if you go back to the how you decided to make the investment to break the British sterling, I heard you say this somewhere. It seemed to be like made up of three main parts of the analysis. So there was a George Soros. You said he's a tremendously insightful psychologist, political economist, and scenario builder. That's not the kind of analysis that people use Excel spreadsheets for?
Well, they say figures don't lie, but liars figure, right? George's intuitive pattern recognition, and he used to explain that he thought this came from having lived in Hungary as a child when the Nazis invaded. And so his, we might call, tuning forks of understanding social instability were heightened and remained a tremendous asset for him throughout his career. And I think that's largely true.
I believe scenario planning is a really good way to basically do investment analysis or business planning. And so you said scenario builder. I'm interested what you meant by that.
Well, if you look at, say, where the data is, and something doesn't look like it's on a steady course, or how would I say, what economists would say, in equilibrium, you start to imagine what kind of adjustments might happen, what might happen, not just to the currency, but what might happen to bond prices and equity markets. So vis-a-vis the British pound, the focus on export sector equities. So when you hit the currency, if it breaks open, bond yields are going to come down because they're not stressing to keep the exchange rate fixed. And equities in the export sector are going to take off. So you're thinking about value generation from a dynamic. And then you think about it otherwise, which is if they do crunch with high interest rates and decide to preserve the ERM, what's going to get hurt? The interest-sensitive sectors, things like a mortgage market, commercial real estate, etc. So you kind of have scenarios of either with the devaluation or with the defense, and what happens, and you're investing in what I'll call multiple plays as things unfold. I think part of the value of doing this scenario analysis is deepen your sensitivity to the indicators that may be telltale signs of what will happen.
Right. I mean, it's straight out of my playbook, for sure. Let me just recapitulate some of the mechanisms around the British pound devaluation. Let me re-summarize it this way. So the British pound was effectively fixed against the Deutschmark within a little range.
Yeah, 2.25% or something like that.
Right. And because essentially Germany's going through growth because they're investing and there's unification, and essentially Britain's in a recession, certainly comparatively, there's pressure for the Deutschmark to valuation increase and the pound to decrease. And so they're stabilizing that by the British government buying pounds and selling Deutschmarks.
You know, that's foreign exchange intervention. And then the use of the interest rates. British have to raise or Germans will fall. But as I said at the outset, when the trauma from past inflation affected Germany and they're doing a fiscal stimulus, they're not going to cut interest rates and tolerate higher inflation, which affects what they call the real exchange rate, which is the nominal exchange rate adjusted for the relative change in the price levels within the countries.
Right. So the two main levers are the buying or selling, essentially the currency, and then the interest rates. Because what happens is investors will be investing, it's called the carry trade, right? They'll invest into country if the interest rates are high, which has basically been happening to the United States now. High interest rates are attracting foreign investment, which is causing the dollar to go up. And if we had a fixed dollar to euro, right, or yen, the yen appreciated something like from 100 or so yen to the dollar to 150 at one point in the last 6 months. If there'd been a fixed exchange rate, that would put a lot of pressure on that exchange rate. And that's what was happening then. And you saw that as unsustainable and actually unhealthy for the British government. And then in the actual day-to-day interactions, you could see that it was basically an uncomfortable situation for them. So that's just to recapitulate that for people.
The one other thing is you mentioned the tools they had was either foreign exchange intervention or changing the interest rates in Britain up or in Germany down. So we take Germany down off because of the anxiety about inflation. Now what they have left is they raise rates or they do intervention. Because we, and then the stampede our counterparties created, we started to eat up all of their reserves. at which time, if they ran out of reserves, the only thing they could do was raise rates. And if we didn't think that was sustainable, we had a very brilliant stock analyst who worked on the UK named Scott Bessent as part of our team. And he just said, it'll just crush this interest-sensitive economy. They won't be able to sustain that for more than, I think he said, 90 days. So what we were doing was taking the probabilities that they'd have to go to interest rates or devalue to a higher probability by speculating against the currency and taking a lot of their reserves. The cushion of the reserves was being depleted.
And just to put some numbers on that, because I think it helps people understand. I think the interest rates before this were about 10%, and they raised them to 15%.
That's right.
Effectively in 48 hours. So imagine raising our interest rates to 15% and then having that still not affect the currency exchange rates. So I think having people understand sort of the context, because it becomes important when you understand the consequences of essentially successfully breaking from the ECM, was good for the economy, essentially.
I was going to say, they called it Black Wednesday because this, other than the dollar, the biggest core reserve currency in the history of the West since the Industrial Revolution had been the British pound. So they consider it kind of an embarrassment to devalue. They were losing their reserve currency status. And that's why they called it Black Wednesday. But when the exchange rate went down, interest rates came down, and the economy started to recover, both export and interest-sensitive sectors, a lot of people changed the name to White Wednesday, like it was a relief that the inevitable happened, and now they could get back on to prosperity and growth.
Right. But there are sort of two really powerful symbolic aspects to what happened that, to some extent, you could roll forward to today. And then one was the British sterling was arguably the global reserve currency, certainly had been for 100 plus years, even more so than the dollar today in the sense of like prestige. I feel like it had more sort of identity with colonialism and...
Yeah, well, with the British Empire and going to China and India and places, that currency became a platform for commerce all around the world.
The empire of monarchy and of sort of British identity. And so that's why it was so significant to Britain.
The prime minister said to the German government just before that the British pound would be the European reserve currency for the foreseeable future. And some consultants that I knew that were familiar with the German government knew the central bank governor, Karl Otto Pohl. He said that was like waving a knife at the Germans. They valued themselves becoming a reserve currency, and their willingness to help preserve the British pound was probably diminished by that confrontation. I learned all of this in the 2 weeks before the devaluation.
You touched on this, but just to, again, recapitulate that, the German Central Bank could have saved the British pound, but wasn't going to, and that was a key part of the analysis.
Yeah, partly because of their own worries about inflation and partly because they wanted to be a reserve currency too.
Right. Great power competition. So a lot of directions to take this, but let me just mention one and put a pin in it. Here we are, 2023. A lot of people are asking questions about U.S. global reserve currency. And essentially, you were the team that ended essentially the previous one.
I would say the British pound had handed the ball to the dollar during the Great Depression in the 30s and through the end of World War II. In other words, it became unquestionably clear that it was the dollar regime after the British devaluation, because the predecessor left what you might call the inner circle. The question is, who's rising to the inner circle? Obviously, the euro became a candidate as they consolidated many of the European countries into that currency. The Chinese RMB is not yet convertible, and that nationalist versus multilateral kind of sensibilities would chase away the Australias, the New Zealands, or whatever. But to be fair, the intra-Asian world, they had a thing called the Chiang Mai Initiative, which was about using the renminbi. They always say there's the store of value, unit of account, medium of exchange. And for a lot of trade-related intra-Asian stuff, the Chiang Mai Initiative was trying to make the renminbi the unit of account. because their capital markets were not open and convertible, they weren't going to be the store of value so much, or even the medium of exchange, because they had kind of built a fort around their country and were not taking what I'll call financial disturbances and shocks from an open capital market yet. But that might be in the next phase. The renminbi might be, I understand that the Chinese government, I don't have specific data, but the Chinese government in recent years had been holding lots of dollars in U.S. government bonds. But in the stresses, particularly since the beginning of the Ukraine war, they have been holding less dollar-denominated assets as a result.
So in some ways, they have the same dilemma as Britain did back then, because they have to choose between essentially the currency and their economy. Because China has chosen their economy and kept their currency cheap so they can be an export-led economy and sell stuff to the United States, and it's very attractive. And then as a result, they built up a lot of dollar reserves. So for them basically to let it float, that could undermine their sort of core engine that's been the driver.
Had the currency appreciated significantly more, the flow of foreign direct investment, the learning from foreign direct investment technologies that they participate would have been substantially diminished. And I think you could see a little bit of a turning point when they put out something they called the China 2025 plan. They were essentially talking about emulating or replacing many of the foreign direct investments with domestic corporations and some of the large-scale capital-intensive American or German companies had envisioned going there and having the comparative advantage in being the dominant firm within a very large-scale economy of over a billion people. But the China 2025 program seemed to say at that end of the spectrum, not the labor-intensive, but the more complex, capital-intensive, digital, we're going to move into those sectors as the next phase of development. And it created a little bit of heartburn in the West, whether it was Silicon Valley or whether it was the financial sector or whoever. I know a lot of people on Wall Street around the time Donald Trump was elected were very unhappy that the Chinese had not allowed more American financial firms to penetrate into their domestic market and build things like Fidelity or Charles Schwab or whatever inside their society that was not permitted.
We're getting to the present, and I don't think I laid the groundwork yet for it. So I still have questions about the British sterling experience, but let me give you the broad narrative here of how I think to frame you for our listeners and your career. So this is how I think about you, and you can tell me what I'm missing. So you spent your career at the fault line between finance and government. That's like the essence of where you, and sometimes you're in government, sometimes you're on business, private sector, sometimes you're in the nonprofit or philanthropy, but that's, you're one of the world experts at that fault line.
Well, I think having had responsibility, I mean, I started working on the Senate Budget Committee, I think when I was 26, and spending roughly 7 years in budget committee, Republican side, banking committee, Democrat side, having a mentor. Paul Volcker was a very private mentor to me in many respects. I learned a lot from him, including a lot about fishing off the coast of New Jersey and stuff like that. He was a good fisherman. And I worked a little bit on a book that was considered outside, Secrets of the Temple, which was describing what I'll call a translation of what's going on in governance and political economy and central banking to the more general public. But I guess then migrating north, 1989, to Bankers Trust, then Soros, and I worked a little, another year with Lewis Bacon and Moore Capital. Then it was in the cockpit of understanding how to make money with the understanding of policy and governance and all the things that were on this, we might call the other side of the ledger that I used to occupy. And I thought it was helpful. It was helpful to have had the government experience when assessing things in the private sector.
But then after all of that, you go back to essentially public service, and you spend the last 20 plus years, I would think of you as like a policy warrior.
you know, it's interesting. I was working with a man named Alex Gibney on a lot of film, documentary film and music documentaries, particularly. He won the Oscar for Taxi to the Dark Side. And before that, we worked on the Enron film, Smartest Guys in the Room. I would say the great financial crisis was like a call to action. When the TARP legislation was being crafted, everybody from the senior staff on both the Dodd side and the Frank side are people I'd been conferring with regularly. And a man named Robert Duggar, who's a dear friend of mine who had worked with the House and Senate banking committees, lived in Alexandria. I went down and camped in his house, and he and I worked with those staffs on the TARP legislation and then for months thereafter on what became the Dodd-Frank legislation. But the structure of the bailouts and figuring out what was wrong and figuring out what you want to do about it. And a lot of the people who were the senior people with Dodd and Frank were people who used to be colleagues or deputies of ours when Duggar and I worked on the banking committees. So it was a fascinating call back to policy, call back to public service, if you will, not officially, but I worked very closely with lots of people. And I'll have to pay a little bit of tribute. A gentleman who convinced me to become an economist was MIT professor Charles Kindleberger. He had spent a lot of his life in policy with the New York Fed, working on the Marshall Plan, and all kinds of things. And so he had that sense. And he was also what I will call with his book, Mania, Panics, and Crashes, and so forth, he was not an equilibrium finance economist. He was more like Frank Knight, radical uncertainty, the unknown unknowns, and the unknowable unknowns. That informed, as a matter of fact, it helped for me and George Soros to connect. George had written the book, Alchemy of Finance, right around the time I first met him. Karl Popper had been a mentor, and the unknowable unknowns was very much a part of how he saw the dynamic of analyzing financial markets.
What I love about you, Rob, is whenever I talk to you, you sort of incidentally mention somebody that's like a legend.
Yeah.
Teed me up for so many things, I'm struggling with which to pick. Let me just stay with the background because you laid out so much, not everybody appreciated what you just said. So yeah, you get a PhD in economics at MIT, right?
No, undergraduate economics at MIT. I studied economics and electrical engineering and a good deal of arms control and disarmament. But Bob Solo and Kindleberger persuaded me to go to graduate school in economics. They were very close to Alan Blinder, Joseph Stiglitz, and others. So I went to Princeton at their suggestion. And when I got to Princeton, I did the program. I met some really fascinating people like Albert Hirschman, Marcello DiCecco from Italy, and I would say the most prominent influence was Axel Leyenhufvud, who was a UCLA professor, but an alternative thinker, kind of like Kindleberger, and he really nurtured a lot of thinking and got me to take a lot of interesting history courses on social instability.
Yeah, there you are doing it again, just casually mentioning Alan Blinder and et cetera. So Charles Kindleberger, so for people who haven't read him, wrote a book called Manias, Panics, and Crashes. And so he's the definitive expert on history of financial crises. He's either number one or number two ever. So you study under him. So that really steeps you into the sort of world of financial crises. But he was the architect of the Marshall Plan. And then he gets drummed out of government because of McCarthyism, totally unjustly on many levels.
Harry Dexter White was at the Treasury, who worked with Charlie from the New York Fed, and they were kindred spirits. And people were accusing at the McCarthy time Harry Dexter White of being an informant or an ally to the Soviets. And Kindleberger was blockaded, removed from all the high security clearances and so forth in that time, that hostility and purging. And he was taken out of the inner circle, if you will.
Right. Maybe the unintended benefit to society was he wrote the book. He may not have written that book if he hadn't been thrown out of government.
I'll encourage your listeners to read Perry Merling's new book about Charles Kindleberger. I think I have a copy of it right here. It's from the iNet series. It's called Money and Empire, Charles P. Kindleberger and the Dollar System. Cambridge University Press, in their iNet New Economic Thinking series, put the book out.
I want to come back to Paul Volcker because you casually mentioned that he was a mentor and close friend for probably a few decades. Let me just run through the rest of it. You were chief economist at the Senate Banking Committee. You mentioned that. And then the last 20 years or so, you started the Institute for New Economic Thinking, which is another category of things to dig into. You were at the center of the maelstrom during 2008 Great Financial Crisis. I didn't know you and Rob Duggar were friends, but I got to get Rob on the show. He's a great guy. So I, as an outsider, was very critical of TARP. I think Dodd-Frank's probably saving the banking system today. If not for Dodd-Frank, the entire banking system would be in another true financial crisis. And Dodd-Frank's probably the only thing that saved us, literally, today. Dodd-Frank has been, and now in retrospect, a really, really valuable policy or whatever legislation. But TARP, help me understand, what am I missing, or do you agree that ended up being a big mistake?
Joe Stiglitz famously said when TARP was passed, that's an error. They paid the polluters. And when Dodd-Frank didn't restructure mortgages and change what you might call the dissemination of assistance, a lot of people would say it fomented social distrust and instability. Lots of things like Gallup polls on expertise in government institutions. The Federal Reserve went from one of the top two all the way to the bottom very quickly because people viewed them as bailing out the people who made the mess. There was a lot of resistance inside the Paulson Treasury to what you might call diluting the holdings of the bondholders or the equity stake of management or what have you, with equity injections, though they ultimately did do some of that. But I thought the TARP legislation was, it had to be done in a hurry and it had to pass, but it didn't convey a broad-based sense of social justice. And on Audible, David Sirota and Alex Gibney's podcast called Meltdown. And the point of Meltdown is not that the markets melted down. The point of Meltdown is trust in governance and expertise around finance melted down, and it led to Occupy Wall Street, Tea Party, changing of the House from Democratic to Republican, changing of the Senate from Democratic to Republican, and Donald Trump becoming president. Even people like Steve Bannon said, had there been a more just bailout, his father lost his pension working with AT&T. Because of it. And Bannon has said, I'm not a Bannon fan, or I don't know the guy, but I've seen him speak. And he said, Trump never would have been president if that bailout hadn't been so bad.
Yeah, for me personally, it was probably the seminal moment in my career because I came out of it so jaded about the financial system. And I started Fundrise because I was on a mission to try to build a different, hopefully better system. I often imagine, okay, if Franklin Roosevelt had been elected, how would he have sort of run, or how would you, if you know, you're elected president, it's happening, crisis hits the world in October 2008, imagine you or Roosevelt wins the presidency November 4th. What's like a counterfactual?
To be fair, the Obama administration, they were inaugurated in January 21st of 2009. So a lot of the play, meaning the implementation, had taken place between September of 2008 when they started through the TARP legislation implementation. A lot of that was already way in motion so that when Geithner and Summers and everybody came into the White House, it wasn't like they had a clean slate. They inherited something that had already become legislation and then had to evolve it.
Hold on, I want to debate that for 1 minute, if you don't mind. If you go back and look at Roosevelt, when he gets elected, back then you got elected in April and didn't start, I think it was April, and then you wouldn't start your presidency until January. And that was like, they changed it because it was such a long delay. And Hoover, in the middle of the Great Depression, he tries to get Roosevelt at the table to help him fix essentially the crisis. And Roosevelt refuses. He basically lets the crisis get worse. And Hoover holds the bag. So when the day comes in office, basically at that point, he can do anything he wants. And he, in the first 100 days, they pass the 33 Act, 34 Act, create the SEC. They do all these things that are the modern New Deal. I look back on Geithner and Summers. I mean, they started working. I mean, it was a crisis. I understand why they did that, but they started working with Paulson the day they were elected. It was a partnership. And I always wonder.
Well, Tim Geithner was the head of the New York Fed coming into it. So he was at the center table all through the Paulson time, not knowing necessarily that he'd be the Treasury Secretary, but he was playing that role as the president of the New York Fed right from the get-go.
Right. It wasn't like the Obama administration didn't have some fingerprints on it from November to January.
Mm-hmm. But what I felt was the augmentation that could have been done, for instance, I'll just pick on a generic notion, like Citibank. Instead of giving them so much advance, you could have written things down, restructured some of their debt, injected equity, diluted the existing owners' equity participation, and used some of what you saved in the fiscal transfer by knocking them all down. Could have been then to create mortgage relief for some of the people that were underwater in mortgages that were, whether it's, I remember Nevada had a lot of very huge numbers of mortgages that just were overwhelming and basically were bankrupting everybody. And so that, what I'll call broader dissemination of relief, I believe the famous quote that Tim Geithner uses, we're foaming the runway so that you could land the big planes without crashing. But it was that preserving the big centers of the financial sector with the money that we had rather than disseminating it to the broader public that was suffering from the stress.
If you could wave a magic wand, right, you would have basically done more like what Steven Rattner did during the GM bankruptcy. He restructured all the debts and it was a much more balanced execution than I think what happened with the banks.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Detroit, so I heard good things about that, but then I heard some bad things that said they allowed them to use some of the money to build new plants in Mexico and China. I don't know if that's factual or not, but there were people with graduate degrees in Michigan that were reaching out to me saying, what's going on with that? But the impetus to alleviate stress was much more broadly spread by the Rattner plan.
Yeah, more balanced in terms of its effect on people and companies.
Yes.
The three other topics I'm interested in covering are China and East Asian markets, because he's been going to China, working in China, working in East Asian markets for 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
To me right now, that's actually maybe the most important thing, maybe the scariest thing happening in the world. It's highest risk in terms of magnitude. And then the other two, if we had time, is about the great inflation and the Fed's policy currently, because I think you have thoughts around that I'm interested to hear. So maybe those two topics, if we get through both.
The great inflation, are you referring back to the time of Volcker coming in and Jimmy Carter, or?
Oh, I meant now.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, I see. Gotcha. You want to talk about China first, or you want to talk about the inflation first?
Let's do China first, because I feel like it's something that I'm really interested in your thoughts on.
First of all, I've been going to China since about the time of Tiananmen Square, a little before. And I maintained an interest there. I have three daughters, all of whom have taken Mandarin in school. My older children, who are now 35 and 34, spent summers in China. We were very fortunate in those days that one of our neighbors and good friends was Ray Dalio, the famous hedge fund manager, and Ray was very interested in China. Yeah, he's a legend. But he was curious as could be about what was happening in China, and it helped my curiosity. His son set up a lovely foundation helping with the one-child policy when girls were put up for adoption to get them adopted in the United States. It was called China Cares. But anyway, China was a curiosity, both philosophically and for investment opportunities. And after the British pound devaluation and so forth, I shifted my focus to running the China, what's called the Quantum Emerging Growth Fund. And I had other people like Arminio Fraga working with me on Latin America, and my focus was on non-Japan Asia. I guess I should hat tip a little bit. My former wife, Bonnie, was the head of Japan analysis in the 80s at the Federal Reserve. working closely with Volcker and then Alan Greenspan. And so I learned a lot about Asia even before China. But when I go to Japan, those guys would all tell me, you got to go to China and check this out. And they were shifting, starting about 1994, they were shifting. When China devalued their currency, they're shifting away from places like Malaysia and Thailand for their foreign direct investment and towards the China mainland. That's part of what created the 1997-98 Asian financial crisis. But in China, I was acutely aware. There's a gentleman who's a friend of mine named Orville Schell. He ran the China program for the Asia Society, and he's based in Berkeley, California. He wrote a book with a man named John DeLary that I would encourage everyone to read right now. It's called Wealth and Power. And it's about what I will call a kind of geopolitical collision, where you go from a G7, which is kind of a Cartesian Enlightenment Western thinking, to a G20 that has India and China on deck. Now you have two different philosophical systems. That creates the capacity for misunderstanding because you see the world from a different lens. That's about mistakes, not about danger. But the second part was that the Chinese experienced something they called the century of humiliation, from the sense that they were losing a leadership role, the opium wars, the development of manufacturing where they were way behind the curve and the British Empire was leading. And that carries on for 101 years to 1943 with the Japanese invasion of China, which they felt like they got beat up by their little brother, to put it in a silly metaphor. So you had China coming to this table. Originally, places like Walmart and Nike and others just were building plants there. Wages were low. Environmental constriction was not a problem. And they started to develop momentum. China started out, I think, with a per capita income about 1/40th of the American average, and they started climbing up. But as they became more sophisticated, their desire, this is before the time of Xi Jinping, their desire to become a partner at the head table was reemerging. So now you have a G20 where China doesn't want to be a subordinate in a U.S. system. They want to be a partner, a full partner. And the United States was getting frustrated, as I mentioned earlier, with the China 2025 program. This is all even before Donald Trump ran for president, 2013, 2014. Xi Jinping put a tremendously large and powerfully impactful exhibit at the China History Museum in Beijing, all about the history of China's faltering and how it was going to regain its national dignity. If you watch a bunch of the Chinese movies, Lust, Caution, and Wolf Warrior 2, and all of these have this built in to the fabric. And these are the movies that the Chinese people just loved. It was playing to that desire to regain dignity. I'm not talking about overreaching the United States and it being a Chinese system. I'm talking about there being partners at the head table. Going back to Orville Schell's book, Wealth and Power, he was saying they come from different philosophical systems. The Chinese have this yearning and America wants to be in control. And if we're not careful, we're going to have unnecessary losses. So as we move to the current circumstance, we have a place and a time where the need to collaborate on climate change for the largest economies in the world is obvious. The disintegration rather than integration of commerce, the deglobalization is creating some of what you call the new great inflation, the supply shock, controversies and tensions that Trump's presidency exacerbated have continued at the time of the Biden administration. I've recently made podcasts with Jim Chanos, who's very knowledgeable about the Chinese economy. Stephen Roach, formerly head of Asia for Morgan Stanley, is now at Yale teaching about U.S. and China. And the anxiety about the potential for unnecessary losses is quite profound. And obviously with Taiwan and the possibility of a nuclear exchange, as Daniel Ellsberg would tell you in his amazing book, The Doomsday Machine, an exchange like that won't just kill a few people on the coast. It'll destroy the upper atmosphere and the ability to grow food and nourish many places on planet Earth. Stakes are very, very high. Daniel, who I know, is nearing the end of his life, and people are making films and other things about his warning signs. He was an insider with Henry Kissinger, and before that with Robert McNamara and the Cuban Missile Crisis and through the Nixon administration. He worked at Rand Corporation. He's a PhD in economics from Harvard. He knows what he's talking about, and he had tremendous courage. So I think there's an ominous, avoidable thing vis-a-vis U.S. and Taiwan and China. I think the climate work needs to progress. There's an old saying that when Bismarck couldn't solve things in Germany, he created a policy, pick a foreign enemy and get everybody to unify around that common enemy. And I'm afraid with the divisiveness in the United States right now that, and perhaps similarly in China, each side is underestimating the costs of breakdown because they're playing their breast-beating nationalistic strategies.
Let me go back to the lead up to this. How do you think about sort of a mercantilism policy, right? A mercantile policy, which I think is China's policy, and our sort of free trade policy, and that sort of asymmetry and the consequences? Because I think that has created a lot of the social and political context for where we are today. A quick note to listeners. Mercantilism essentially means achieving national growth through protectionism and trade barriers.
There are a couple sides to that. One is when you have a free trade policy, the mantra in economics is you can make everybody better off and nobody worse off. But when you start with China at 1/40th of the per capita income of America and you do globalization, you're going to have to invest a lot of money in what I'll call transformational assistance. You can't just wipe out all of the what I'll call high-level manufacturing because it moves to China, have everybody become a hamburger flipper, and then say it's all okay. And I have talked with very high-level Chinese leaders, I mean like vice presidents and so forth, very top people, and they've said to me, Robert, for a long time when we kept our currency low, we were being encouraged by the companies that were making foreign direct investment and exporting back to the United States. They kept the RMB lower with American advice than they would have themselves. Secondly, and this is the most important thing, they said, we have no control over adjustment assistance in the United States. We're not like the island of Tonga. If that becomes part of the world system, it's so small it doesn't make any impact. We have 1.4 billion people. If we do this integration, which we started basically in the 1980s, it is going to create a lot of transformation, and you need things like community colleges and support for travel and moving and all kinds of things. It will be disruptive, but that's the responsibility of the American government. And what they did was they didn't tax their wealthy people. They let their wealthy people keep their money offshore, and then they say they can't afford it. They watch their school systems rot. And in the distress, all kinds of polarity and racial hostility and everything arose. These are Chinese people saying, we can't solve that problem. That's an American governance problem about what I'll call distributional issues or transformational issues. They don't think they have a strategy that is causing this. They think it's the failure of our strategy.
We haven't had a domestic policy that essentially address those issues, you're saying. And we do seem to be starting, in some regards, our industrial policy around the chips. We are finally investing in domestic manufacturing in a really meaningful way. So we got the message, but the message seems to be the U.S. has to be a mercantile economy too, right? That feels like where we're going.
There was a lot of energy within the national security community. People I first met when I worked in the Republican Party with Pete Domenici, who stayed in that civil service role. I won't name them because they're largely high security people, but they have said to me that they were concerned as Silicon Valley became more vital, how they all went to Asia and which might call leaked their secrets the things that DARPA and other groups that were defense-related helped to nurture in Silicon Valley, those technologies were being deployed and imitated in China that had national security implications. And they wanted America to be more mercantile and more careful about what they deployed overseas. And they thought that the free market energy of these new successful profitable entities, you know, like Amazon and Google and so forth, Apple, had some frightening side effects. I didn't sense until a time a little bit later that we were protectionists, but I do sense, since this tension has come forward, that places that are involved in the digital world in China are persona non grata for deploying anything in the United States. So you can't say we're free trade entirely and that they're mercantile. The blockages are in both directions.
Yeah, well, it seemed like, I think back when Clinton helped make China a member of the World Trade Organization, I think the hope was that China would become like us. But it seems like what's happened is we're going to be more like China as an economic policy.
I think you're right. It started around the time of the beginning of the Trump administration. But when China was saying with 2025 policy, we're going to do more things than let foreign direct investment come in and teach us, we're going to start building substitutes for those foreign direct investments. And when they didn't get access to the financial markets, which obviously the U.S. has a comparative advantage at implementing, then they felt like in the U.S. we had to be more mercantilist because they were being mercantilist and nationalistic. There was a lot of talk in China in those days about, originally they set their education system up to pick a very few people who were super smart and bring them into the government that ran things centralized from the top. There was a movement, this started probably around 2012, to really build education for digital engineering-like education much more broadly throughout the country, because people who had migrated to the farms, to the cities, weren't just going to work with their hands, they wanted to work with their minds. And so the Chinese were trying to climb, which you might call that human capital ladder, during that time. But as things got more tense past 2016, I think both sides reverted to more angst or suspicion about the other. I'll recommend to you and your audience a website. It's called China Heritage. A man named Jeremy Barme set it up, and it's essentially about what do we think of China? What does China think of us? How do we evolve from both sides? There are people in China who want to emulate a more democratic system like America. There are all kinds of cross currents, and what he calls the Invisible Republic of the Spirit, which is a name that comes from a gentleman named Stefan Zweig talking about the onset of World War I. But the Invisible Republic of the Spirit is about how do we create a common collaborative understanding. And it's hypotheses and explorations. It's not dogmatic, but it's well worth it.
The rise of President Xi Jinping and the alliance with Russia around the invasion of Ukraine, how does that square with your firsthand experience working in China? How does that make sense to China?
I am a little bit surprised. I would say, to be candid, I would be very critical of Xi Jinping. First of all, with the stalling out of the world economy related to the pandemic, most of his trading partners are on the U.S.-Ukraine side of that. So he may have done something, while it might create imports of oil or something, it may damage the growth potential from global commerce for having sided with the wrong team, or at least not remained neutral.
Advocating for integration, not disintegration. What's the interpretation that is like favorable for what they're doing?
I don't think there is a favorable thing that you just surrender to. What I'm saying is I've got four children and three grandchildren. And I don't want to see a nuclear war or a disintegration from climate change, so that there are things that compel us to work together and work out our differences with much more focus and vigor and intensity than either side appears to be doing right now. There was a little flash of good news when the G20 met right after the midterm election, which is probably the days when Biden can be the most cooperative, because the next election is the furthest off. In other words, you just finished one and now it's 2 years. And he went to Indonesia and he and Xi Jinping had a relatively constructive conversation. Things have backpedaled since that time with the shooting all the balloons and all the other stuff. But I don't want to, what I'll say, have rose-colored glasses. Like, I don't think China is a challenge given the structure of leadership. I think they hurt their own population, they hurt their own economy, and they hurt us. But I also think for them, going back to Orville Schell's perspective, wanting to be at the head table, they got to feel like they're being treated with respect, not being condescended to or told to get in line behind America.
One last, maybe not so small question, but it seems to me that China's pretty clear about their intention on Taiwan, and our policies are at cross purposes. How do you square that? Because I don't believe that the answer is that it'll essentially will never integrate it, which is like the present will continue into the future as a stable status quo.
Well, it's difficult to understand how you would evolve things. I know that Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea are quite close and interact quite a lot. So to feel like they're being plucked out of that system when America is an ally to that system is a bit haunting. On the other side of it, I don't know that an attack with planes and ships and bombs is doing anything that creates an integration of the two places. I have not seen, this may be my own neglect of curiosity since the pandemic time, but I have not seen somebody put forward a visionary plan of Taiwan collaboration with the People's Republic of China and perhaps some of the West or this other parts of Asia. It doesn't need to be either or. But when things are damaged and polarized between the leaders, I guess it becomes a litmus test for Chinese strength, given their woundedness from the century of humiliation. I don't see a lot of what you might call material gain or anything from engaging in a war and coercively taking them over. But I don't know. You may have other people who see that.
Yeah, it's just that we were wrong about Ukraine, so it's hard to estimate at the moment. Here, so let me change now to one of your true expertise, which is about economics and looking at the current state of the world. So the inflation has been high, labor markets have been tight, and the Fed policy has basically argued that they're going to break the back of inflation by keeping rates high and likely driving up unemployment. So what's your critique of that or policy recommendations?
It's a bit delicate, but what I would say is this. I worked for a famous oil economist named Maurice Edelman in the 1970s as a research assistant. Kindleberger and he were working on petrodollar recycling. Bob Solo, who was my advisor, was working on the Phillips curve. And what he basically said is in the production function, it's not just labor and wages as a trade-off, but there's another factor, which is oil prices. So you got a supply shock from OPEC that would shift to the Phillips curve. And the question at that time was that we'd come out of the 60s, we had a tremendous amount of power in the labor movement. Labor share of compensation in GDP relative to capital share was much higher then. So the idea that you're going to take a tight labor market that's unionized and somewhat militant and cool their jets, which is the Volcker cleanup, during a bit of a chaotic time when Jimmy Carter was president, there were things going on in Iraq and Iran and so forth. So all of the tensions, we couldn't control OPEC, and many of the U.S. petroleum companies didn't want us to. They liked higher oil prices and being profitable. But what I guess I would say now is that the labor movement's nowhere near as strong. I think that the economy, after almost 13, 14 years of very low interest rates ever since the 2008 crisis, is quite leveraged up, etc. And going, as Jay Powell has been advertising, like an accelerated hawk to crush inflation, is exacerbating the hostility that Donald Trump was able to cultivate. It's not fortifying human capital. It's not doing any kind of what I'll call transformational assistance. It's crushing the people who didn't make the mess. And I think that foments a great deal of political economic discord in the United States in the coming 2 to 3 years. The second thing, like we've just seen with the Sun Valley Bank and others, is a lot of people were very comfortable with very low interest rates as funding costs. And they were buying houses with 2% mortgages and watching it appreciate and all that. I think reversing all of that right now has to be done on a longer horizon and more gently. I think the key thing, and this is why I'm not saying it's all right or it's all wrong, when you look at the sources of inflation, there's a wonderful INET working paper by our research director, Tom Ferguson, and a man named Servaas Storm, which places like the Financial Times and others have all been citing about what were the sources of inflation in this supply shock regime. And there are very few things that interest-sensitive demand reduction will curtail. But the one qualification I would put in is, if people feel that inflation is going to continue, they're going to start trying to build it into the dynamic. In other words, it's not a level adjustment and then level off. It becomes the rate of change, the velocity of prices. And so you have to convince people that it will not go on so that they're not exacerbating the inflation we've already had by continued markups. But the labor market is not nearly as strong in its bargaining power now as it was at the time of Volcker. And I think if I were Jay Powell, in light of what just happened with Sun Valley Bank and the guarantees that have just been offered, I'd take a pause here for a couple of 3 months.
Silicon Valley Bank. So what's your forecast or forecasts for how this plays out? What's the scenario planning here?
I think the best thing that could happen is to have a negotiated settlement in the Ukraine. I think if that took some of the sting out of things, U.S.-China could get back on to a more collaborative course. I can see India working to develop renewables energy. They don't have as much fossil fuel. They have a lot of coal. But I could see them getting on track to make a substantial contribution. I think you could see the multilateral institutions like the World Bank contributing some financing to the Global South that helps with climate change and supports aggregate demand growth. I think if you don't stop what's happening in the Ukraine, you're going to have problems with fertilizer and grains going into Africa. And given the young population there, and the rise of temperatures in an equatorial region, so subsistence farming is harder to do, you're going to see outward migration on a very large scale. So I don't have a yellow brick road to the land of Oz, but I see lots of ways that you could step forward and mitigate the extent of the discord and the challenges that we're all facing.
So you were very close with Volcker. He was your mentor. You understood a lot of how he thought. So Volcker's in the Fed today. What's he doing compared to our current approach?
I don't know Jay Powell, so I don't know how to compare the internal dynamics. I've worked with a lot of Fed board members and Senate Banking Committee over time. I believe that Paul Volcker was kind of wired like Charles Kindleberger at that intersection between policy and not quite such a, what you might call, quantitative, believe in the models kind of guy. I don't know where Jay Powell is. I know he worked in a private equity world and all. But Paul was deeply knowledgeable and impressive about his knowledge and his, what you might call, flexibility. He wasn't at all dogmatic. And if I think he were there today, I think he'd be listening to people. I used to watch him in conversation with Pete Domenici. I got my job with Domenici through Paul. And the nuance and the suppleness and so forth that Paul was capable of was really extraordinary. And he was also not nearly as what I'll call ego needy of being patted on the head, made into a hero or anything of the sort, as a lot of people who are leading public officials. He had a deep sense of self. When I set up the Institute for New Economic Thinking, there were, Robert Duggar was a co-founder, a man named Anatole Kolesky, and George Soros provided initial seed funding. But I went right to Paul Volcker to explore what to do. I want to add one thing on tribute to Paul. In the last phase of his life, and Ray Dalio did help fund it, Paul Volcker built something called the Volcker Alliance. And what was the focus of that? Improving and deepening the education of people that would work in the public sector managing the economy. He didn't like that idea that just worship the markets and the government, you know, the Reaganism of the government's just all bad. And government's the problem, not the solution. He saw the interaction between government and markets required sophistication and high quality on both sides with a sense of the common good and the sense of the vitality of private initiative being aligned. And I think Paul was quite taken aback, I'll call after the Greenspan years, about essentially the wealthy and the powerful cheerleading for the dot-com bubble and then more. And I think that he perceived and was much more on watch than I've seen other Fed governors in my entire lifetime about financial fragility in a global system where, say, if someone like Michael Greenberger, who's at University of Maryland, used to be at the CFTC, studied the competition between the financial centers like London, New York, Frankfurt, Paris, etc., and how they would create what might call less onerous disclosure or capital requirements, whatever, to attract business to their city. And it created in Paul's mind and in my own fault lines, which would come back to haunt you. It's not unlike the Enron. You have special purpose vehicles off balance sheet that aren't reporting, and then all of a sudden the bombs go off and it comes running right back into the center of the holding company. Frank Portnoy wrote an excellent book about this pertaining to 2008. So I guess I don't know how Paul would be, but every time I talked to him, it was nuanced and supple, not dogmatic and mindless. And so I would think he would be experiencing the dilemmas right now. And it's not just go crush inflation, be a hero, because you're crushing all kinds of things that have other side effects in that process.
Right. We're seeing that as we speak. So, Rob, I really appreciate you coming on. This was just sensational. Onward.
Well, what I want to say is your curiosity gives me hope. You're not only your expertise, because I've always enjoyed talking with you, but your curiosity and the way you try to illuminate things for people. I don't pretend I'm right or wrong, but I like to explore. because I think if we explore together, we'll find constructive ways. And if we stay in our little cabins, in our little isolated huts, we'll create unnecessary losses. So thank you for inspiring me to learn from your community. I'm interested in the feedback, and maybe we'll do something.
Thank you so much for joining. You've been listening to Onward, the Fundrise podcast, featuring Rob Johnson. My name is Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you like what you've heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. We'll see you next episode.